This is Dr. Elaine Phillips in her teaching on the book of Micah, Prophet Outside the Beltway. This is session number 7, Micah chapter 6.
We are moving into chapter 6 at this point, and probably of the sections of Micah that is most known, maybe I should say that are most known, chapter 6, verse 8 is one of them. Clearly, as Perry said last time, the prophecy about a ruler born in Bethlehem is very much there. But what does the Lord require of you is one of our significant passages. In order to work up to that, we really do need to review theological themes. So I want to run through a couple of theological reminders, because this particular chapter is chock full of things that are based on covenant. So forgive me, but we need to do this. In the covenant relationship, it's the Lord and his people that are in relationship. And so we're going to see more than once, we already have, my people. And that shows up in chapter 6 particularly. We're going to see God's mighty acts and his prophetic word for his people. One of the things we talked about in chapter 4 was learning the ways of the Lord, and the fact that included knowing what he has done for them and what he requires of them. So those things will be very significant as we step into chapter 6. Part of the covenant relationship is also being well aware that there are consequences as these people live within relationship. Blessings for obedience, chastisements or disobedience, we've certainly referred to those over and over again. They will come through again in chapter 6. At the beginning of chapter 6, when the Lord, through Micah, calls them into a covenant dispute, generally speaking, heaven and earth are called as witnesses. There are going to be some interesting changes in that, if you want to call it a formula, as Micah addresses this and as the Lord addresses it as well. We'll see that. Further theological reminder, just to kind of get it back on the table, is that the prophets were called to address broken covenant when the people had been disobedient. So they bring charges. There's going to be a covenant dispute, and chapter 6 is all about that. We've already seen that the prophets warn about chastisements, and they're measure for measure, to the point that the Lord will respond in measure. But these things alternate as well with promises of restoration. Those are the prophetic messages, not just Micah, but others as well. A couple of things we also want to just get back on the radar screen in terms of the rhetoric that the Lord, speaking through Micah, will use, because we're going to see it in chapter 6. Probably the most prominent one are understated allusions that presume knowledge of historical and theological background. We're going to see this happen, especially as the Lord calls them to remember. And that declaration to remember is very brief, but if you remember those fill-in-the-blank exams you used to have when you were in school, sometimes they asked you to remember a whole lot. And to all intents and purposes, Micah, the Lord, they together are asking the people to fill in the blanks in terms of what God has done with them. They're supposed to know this stuff. In addition, as we've already seen in Micah, we're going to see it again, there are shifting speakers. That's going to be particularly interesting in verses 7 and 8. We'll come back to how that works when we get there. Nothing new here, but I just need to get it back on the table. Sometimes the Hebrew is challenging. I've tried my best to do a primarily literal translation at some points, and especially in verses 9 and 10 of chapter 6, I will grind a little bit to a halt, but we'll do the best we can. Need to get a quick review again of our preceding chapters, because the reason I'm doing this again is because as we move into chapter 6 with the call to the covenant dispute, it's based on everything that's been said before. The Lord has warned them, Micah's warned them, and so forth, and there have been these historic or these prophetic vignettes, but we just need to have it all back on the radar screen. So, chapter 1, again, Samaria and Jerusalem are sinning. And we have our lament over our cities in Shvelah. Chapter 2, remembering that Torah has everything to do with not only how they approach God, but how they deal with one another in terms of their living together, loving their neighbor as themselves. And so chapter 2 is addressing terrible injustices, violence, and abuse, which are breaking the covenant in a major way. Chapter 3 continues it. Leaders who ought to be directing their people towards proper behavior instead are instructing entirely the wrong way, and they do it for money, whether it's a prophetic statement of peace when there shouldn't be any, or something else. And so chapter 3 ended with the destruction of the Lord's house. Chapter 4, we saw the joy of many nations streaming up to Zion to learn and walk in the Lord's way. And again, way is an important thing, and it refers to conduct and the transformations. We saw, however, that there is distress, and that distress actually continues into chapter 5 with the remnant and the struggling that they're going to endure. That's after our promise in verse 2 of the shepherd and the king. And then there's judgment of cutting off all these things that are human, ways of protecting themselves, whether it's walled cities, fortresses, horses, chariots, or whether it's some kind of idolatrous allegiance that is going to be, of course, deleterious. With that in mind, here's an overview of chapter 6. And I want to get this all out there so we can kind of see what the development is in this entire chapter before we atomize it into little segments. So there's a dispute. I've said already that we've been working towards this, but now there is a dispute. And the Lord is going to pose the charges, and he's going to call witnesses, and he's going to be the prosecutor, and they are the defendants. This is a serious thing that is now coming to its culmination. As I said earlier, one of the things he does after he calls them to testify against him is he's going to say, remember what I've done for you. And so there's a covenant history lesson. It's short, but my goodness, they are supposed to know all the interspaces or filling in the blanks as well. Well, with the Lord's declaring that, then, you know, in a covenant dispute, presumably both sides have a say. And so in verses 6 and 7, we have the people, the defendants, or one of them, a representative speaker perhaps, but anyway, the questions are being asked. And how are we to approach the Lord? What does he want from us anyway? It almost seems like a question that is a little bit presumptuous. They ought to know the answer to that. Some scholars pose this as representing an entrance liturgy. In other words, how are we to approach? How are we to enter into his sanctuary? And they were hoping for some sort of a structured answer liturgy. It obviously, the answer is really quite different. The next part is our probably best known verse in the chapter and maybe in the entire book. What is good and what does God require? And then, of course, there's going to be a very, very succinct, complete answer there, and we'll spend some time with that. Then there's a transition, and this is where things get a little challenging again. Verse 9. Well, you know, fear the name of the Lord is important in this, and obviously because they haven't been doing that, then the chapter is going to close with more accusations of the things that they've done wrong, transgressing the covenant in every way, and the consequences for that. And then there's a most interesting closure to it. We need to know our history. They needed to know their history. And we're going to come back to that. But we also need to know it because Micah closes with, hey, you've been really intent on keeping the statutes of the house of Omri. Well, again, who was Omri? We're going to have to unpack that as well. So with that overview in mind, covenant is there. The dispute is ready to go. Here comes the summons. And it's verse 1. Hear, therefore, what the Lord is saying. Rise. Now, of course, we're going to ask the question, you know, who is being addressed here? Is it Micah who's supposed to hear? Is the people are supposed to hear? Rise, engage the mountains in the dispute. Let the hills hear your voice. That's the first part of the summons. And I'm going to suggest that the command here is probably directed to Micah. He is supposed to say, and then he is going to be God's covenant enforcement mediator. We've used that term before, quoting Doug Stewart. He's going to be the one who is going to summon the witnesses, and the mountains are going to be part of this. I'm going to say more about mountains in a moment, but let the hills hear your voice, Micah. That's probably why this is addressed to him. There's a Hebrew word, riv, that is used quite frequently, and we're translating it generally as dispute or charge. In the past, there have been those who have translated it as lawsuit, but the current discussions of all this seem to move away from a more narrow understanding of that word as lawsuit and think of it more broadly as a dispute within which charges are being made. As I note for you, it's used as both a verb and a noun, and a number of the prophets are going to employ that particular figure, and these are always issues that are addressed to, well, God's disobedient people, the wayward people. So that's the initial summons. Micah, hear, let the hills hear your voice. Second part of the summons, verse 2. Hear, O mountains. Are you noticing that the mountains are not just passive? There's something that they're being called as part of God's creation to engage this as well. Hear, O mountains, the charge of the Lord, and enduring ones. Lasting foundations of the earth. The enduring ones is a less frequently used Hebrew term, but it's in parallel, all right? And those are the foundations of the earth. For, or because, the Lord has a reeve, a dispute with his people, and he will reeve, verb, contend with Israel. Now, just a note, you know, generally you've got heavens and earth, as I have noted for you before, are summoned as witnesses. That's the standard formula, if you will, that shows up more often than not in the book of Deuteronomy. We see it also in Isaiah chapter 1. And these are the biblical witnesses that are called. As I note for you, in our wider cultural context, when you had treaties, international treaties being made, follow the same kind of formal structure, broadly speaking, and then a wider range of natural phenomena were called to be witnesses because they were viewed as gods. So you have sky, wind, earth, clouds, seas, and so forth and so on. But here in the biblical narrative, it's mountains. Heavens and earth, generally speaking, but here for Micah, it's mountains. Generally speaking, mountains are silent observers. They're immovable. They're lasting. And so there's a sense of solidity there. Now, having said that, I want to just throw one more possible thing to be thinking about here. As I've already said, mountains and hills are enduring silent observers. They don't wear down too quickly. But they're called to hear the Lord. They're called to hear and be engaged as witnesses. So we have some very interesting personification going on, which is not new in the Psalms. You have hills clapping their hands and so forth and so on. But one more, and this is maybe getting out on a limb, but a possible geographical note. Maybe if Micah is speaking in this context, his words are going to reverberate from the hills round about him. If you've ever spoken in any kind of a natural amphitheater, you know how things echo, and there's a kind of an echoing effect, and possibly that is part of it too. They are silent observers, but they're hearing, and maybe they're going to reverberate as they do. Well, that's verses 1 and 2. Let's pick up verse 3. Here comes the Lord's really passionate declaration. My people, it's a covenant. My people, what have I done? And then, of course, the next preposition is interesting. What have I done to you or for you? It can be translated either way. And if it's done to you, and he's then inviting them to testify against him, you know, presumably if they had anything to say, it would be things that he had done against them. But of course, they don't have anything to say because God's been busy providing for them. And so let's take that preposition and say, what have I done for you? And that's what he's going to go on and say. Now, the reason I pause and waver between those two things is because the very next question from the Lord is, how have I wearied you? So he's, you know, he's pushing them. Do they have anything that they can accuse him of? Do they have anything they can accuse him of? And the answer is going to be no. And as I've already said, they're going to have to listen to his recital of what he has done for them. And then he says, answer me. I'm going to say more about that answer me in just a moment. But the Lord is now speaking directly. Yes, Micah is conveying that. But Micah has been told to summon and so forth. And now the Lord says, answer me. Answer me is not just a simple, you know, give me an answer. He's really saying in this context of covenant dispute that we've already talked about, testify against me. If you've got anything to say, testify against me, if you dare, probably. Now, the fact that he says, what have I done? And it's going to deal with some doings and what the Lord has indeed done in his ways and so forth, his righteous acts. In some ways, that's going to be a little pointer ahead to what the people ought to be doing, because they're supposed to do justice, verse 8. So there's some interesting verbal conceptual connections here. Well, since they don't have an answer in terms of being able to testify against the Lord, he is going to let them know what he has done for them. Here's the verse. For I brought you up from the land of Egypt. I'm going to come back to that in a moment. And from the house of bondage, I redeemed you. Parallel statements. Again, Egypt is a house of bondage, brought you up, redeemed you. And I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. It's the only place in the prophets where we have all three of those together. Miriam is, generally speaking, not noted in any of the other prophetic literature. Micah does. We're going to come back to that. But first, brought up, I underlined up in the quotation, and it's stronger than brought out. Oftentimes, as the national narrative is being recited, I brought you out of the house of bondage. And that's wonderful, brought out to get to Sinai and receive Torah. But now, I brought you up. And that implies, I would suggest, their arrival. It's complete. They're actually not just out of bondage, but they've been brought to the promised land. And it's the land promised to Abram way back in Genesis. So very significant, full statement at that point. And so it is indeed Israel's national narrative. It had lasting implications. Interestingly enough, in Deuteronomy 29, and Deuteronomy, of course, is Moses' re-giving the Torah, if you will, after the wilderness generation has died off. And yet he says, we were there. And chapter 4 says that too. There's a Jewish Bible commentator, Rashi, 11th century, who goes on to say, we were there. What does that mean? That means that every generation was there at Sinai for millennia to come. This is the Jewish interpretation of it. Every generation present at Sinai. There's a continuity of corporate reality there. Well, even if you don't want to go along with Rashi, in the biblical text, we have in the Psalms, every generation was to tell the next generation. Psalm 78, verse 4. Psalm 145, every generation is to repeat. And so, interestingly enough, I've just given you a little distillation of that verse from Psalm 78, which is a long psalm. You have recitals of God's covenant history, his covenant relationship with his people, grace peppered with rebellion. Now, I'm mentioning these three representative salvation history psalms because we're going to come back to 106 a little bit later on. Keep in mind that this is a culture that carries on their national narratives by virtue of singing them very often. That's what the Psalms did, was to recite that so they would learn it well. Well, not only did he bring them up, but the Lord says, sent leaders. I sent you leaders. And naming Moses, Aaron, and Miriam could be intended to contrast with the dismal leadership they have at this point in time. Remember, we've had hideous judges, terrible priests, lousy prophets. And so for the people to be called to remember their iconic leadership as embodied in Moses and Aaron, who really were sacrificial, and Miriam, also involved in this, a complete contrast. Sent, the term sent, when he says, I sent you, is also indicative of the fact that the Lord has given them their task. They are true prophets. That's going to be quite a contrast to not only their own contemporary prophets, who are, as we've already said, lousy, but in the incident that the Lord goes on to refer to with Balaam, who kowtowed to Balak, or tried to, he was not a true prophet. He was much more dangerous because he laced prophet and supposedly speaking for the Lord with his own gains, which were based on economic stuff. We're going to come back to that. So, just a couple more things on our Moses and Aaron. In these passages, I note for you, end of Joshua, where Joshua is reciting what's been happening to them. In 1 Samuel chapter 12, when Samuel is giving a review of history before he kind of steps off the scene, refers to Moses and Aaron as well, and then Psalm 105. Just a suggestion with Micah adding Miriam. She too has a part in the redemption narrative. And this is unusual. Micah is, boy, you know, we've seen him insert some unusual things into his prophecies. And of course, it's the Lord speaking through Micah. This would capture their attention. And Miriam was a very interesting presence because from the time she stood on the bank of the Nile watching that little craft carrying Moses through the bulrushes, all the way to teaching the song of their deliverance, the song of Moses, because after he teaches it, she teaches it as well. So we have her serving as a prophet leader. Well, I mentioned the importance of remember a little bit ago, and now let's see what it is they're supposed to remember. And I'm going to suggest how they should have been busy filling in the blanks. All right? So he calls them, remember, my people, remember. Whoa, look what they're supposed to remember, what Balak did, king of Moab. He counseled and what Balaam, son of Beor, answered him. So the first part of their remembrance was, I brought you up out of Egypt. I redeemed you. I sent you leaders. And now, fast forward 40 years, remember what Balak, king of Moab, counseled and what Balaam, son of Beor, answered him. Let's unpack that a little bit and then do a little bit more in terms of how some things are left out that are very important that they should have been knowing. Counsel, it's a very interesting word. It generally speaking means, you know, good advice. But here it's Balak who is counseling. And so the idea is that he's king, and his counsel is supposed to be obeyed. It's authoritative. He's calling the shots, as I indicate here. Now, here's where we have to recognize that God is calling them not just to remember getting out of Egypt and suddenly fast forward to Balak, but I would say he's presuming that they should recall God's faithful provision between Egypt and the Promised Land as well, which included, well, God's righteous acts. Micah is going to refer to God's righteous acts a little bit later on, verse 6. But now part of those are what he has done for them at each step of the way. And here we've got Sinai. Well, my goodness, Torah given there, relationship established, etc., etc., etc. Kadesh, providing for them, water among other things. 40 years in the wilderness. We're told in Deuteronomy their shoes didn't wear out, even though they were wandering for that long. Managed to get around Edom, or through it. defeating the two Amorite kings, Sihon and Og, and then Moab. All of this is part of that in-between coming out and up from Egypt and Balak. I've given you a little map here to kind of see how this works. This is the Sinai Peninsula, and this is our compression in that yellow line, as Micah put it. Out of Egypt, up from Egypt, to the Promised Land, to all intents and purposes. But what they're supposed to know are the following. They're supposed to see how God gave them water at a place where the water had been bitter. They're supposed to see at Rephidim how he cared for them. They're supposed to remember what happened at Sinai, as I just quickly thumbnailed a moment ago. They're supposed to see how he brought them across that dry and terrible, dreadful wilderness. They're supposed to remember what happened at Kadesh and the reasons why they ended up for 40 extra years, because they had sent spies and that didn't go over too well. They're supposed to remember turning away and being directed to turn away, but then suddenly to turn north, not suddenly, after 40 years, to turn north and head along the border of Edom, finally Moab, finally to the place where they're actually going to encounter Balaam and Balak. But that's a long journey, and it's a rather zigzaggy one, isn't it? I would suggest that remember includes all that fill in the blank as well. Well, let's now do a little bit more with this. Once they get to that critical place, just prior, I mean, you know, Moab, the king of Moab, and the Midianites for that matter, have seen this horde of Israelites coming, and they're scared. They know what's been happening, and so they summon Balak. They're to remember that, and I'm reading here, even though Balak offered to pay Balaam really well, and you can read that narrative in Numbers 22 through 24, the Lord turned the curses into blessings, repeatedly. And Deuteronomy 23, the verses 3 through 5, as well as Joshua 24, make it really clear that Balaam didn't just suddenly change his mind. The Lord overruled and turned those curses into a blessing. That's what he's calling them to remember right now. The Lord has turned even someone who presumed to be a prophet of the Lord, because his words, as was already said in Numbers chapter 22, what he said happened. But the Lord will take that and turn it. There also, we need to remember that even though Balaam did have his curses turned into blessings, he still exercised a very wicked streak in himself, because he counseled, as I note for you here, under the table, right? Numbers chapter 25, a horrible debacle at a place called Baal Peor, followed by Numbers 31, the verses I've noted for you, 1 through 16, makes it really clear that what happened at Baal Peor, where the Midianite women seduced the Israelite men to worship the Baal of Peor, what happened there and the absolute awful apostasy there was because Balaam had basically given them advice on how to do that, how to bring the Israelites down. And I would suggest, since we're going to base it on what 2 Peter says, he did it because he loved money. The king had said, I'm not going to reward you because you're blessing these people instead of cursing him. He changes and does it under the table. At any rate, I'm suggesting to you that this example may be what the Lord makes them focus on, because Micah's audience are living in a context where the prophets, well, they pretend to have the word of the Lord. It comes across that way. And Balaam's counsel was a dangerous mixture of truth, but with terrible, terrible falsehood and horrible advice built into it. All right, we could do more with Balaam, but we won't. Even though the text does not say, remember crossing, it just says, you know, remember Shittim and Gilgal. But the point is, in getting from Shittim to Gilgal, they're going from the east side of the Jordan to the west side of the Jordan. Abel Shittim, and I've given you the references, was the last stop before they actually crossed the Jordan and come into the land. And Gilgal, of course, is where they're going to set up those commemorative stones because, as the text of Joshua says, they crossed on dry ground. Because the Lord held back the waters, they cross on dry ground. Of course, the people are supposed to remember, hey, in the Exodus, they crossed on dry ground. Three times, it says in the Exodus account, they crossed on dry ground because the Lord blew the Sea of Reeds away. Well, at any rate, in Joshua 4:24, we have, so that all the peoples may know and you may fear the Lord your God forever. So they're to remember, in a nutshell, that whole deliverance narrative, the guidance, the protection, and the fact that in spite of terrible sins, Baal Peor took place at Shittim. The Lord brought them across. It's almost as if they're on provisional, they're on probation. He's going to bring them into the land. They're on probation. I've suggested some of these additional implications already. Let me just parse them out a little bit and then we'll move on. This is indeed a radical accomplishment of God's purposes. The people have been rebellious, but he gets this job done. There are, however, additional associations. I've said this one already. They were staying at Shittim, Abel Shittim, when the apostasy that I've just briefly thumbnail sketched at Baal Peor occurred. You can read all of Numbers chapter 25. It's a terribly sad, sordid event. Gilgal. Oh, we think of Gilgal. Oh, they're setting up these stones, and of course the word means something about circle. But there are little hints that later on Gilgal has some kind of negative connotations built into it. First of all, when Saul decides to kind of not wait for Samuel to show up, because of course we're coming real close to the end of the time frame, at Gilgal, Saul's going to offer sacrifices, even though Samuel said, wait for me. But further on, both Hosea and Amos reference inappropriate worship at Gilgal. And Hosea 9:15 is really sobering. The Lord began to hate them there, referencing Gilgal. Well, all right, that's the history lesson. They're supposed to remember those things in order to know the righteous acts of God. We've referenced this kind of thing earlier when we talked about the ways of the Lord, and they were supposed to learn those, all these righteous acts of God. In the covenant dispute, the Lord has said, testify against me. They have nothing to say. Instead, he is, as I'm noting here, vindicated by all the things he's done for them. All of these things. Just another reference to 1 Samuel 12. I referenced that a moment ago. But as Samuel is challenging the people, they want a king. Samuel realizes it's not great, but the Lord has said, you know, go ahead and give them their king, but tell them what they're in for. Samuel says, you need to remember, and he uses the same expression, the righteous acts of the Lord. At any rate, back to Micah chapter 6 again. That exchange now sets the stage for the next part of the dispute. The Lord has had his say. What are they going to say back? It involves what happens at the sanctuary, and they are going to ask, maybe a representative person on behalf of they, Israel, are going to ask some questions. As I note for you, this next segment involves what happens at the sanctuary, at the place where they were to go into God's presence, at the place where their sins were atoned for by virtue of sacrifice, and all the things that they had learned when the tabernacle was set up and the priesthood instituted at Sinai. But it seems, as I note, their memories are really thin in this regard. They seem to know some categories, but we're going to see those things really misrepresented and abused. There is a rhetorical shift. I've intimated this already. I'll just say it again. These next verses are questions. They're questions from people. They're questions from someone. We don't know who that someone is. Micah is representing that someone. But how that voice speaks, the tone, the intent, how Micah is representing that, great question. I don't have all the answers. We'll just sort through some of the things that are part of this. But the big issue, as I've suggested, is how you approach the divine presence. A reminder, I've said this already. They knew God's presence. They knew it accompanying them all the way along as a historical people. They were taught how to approach God. That was all the things that had to do with the tabernacle and everything that went on there. They were also taught how to live properly with justice in the presence of God. They knew this. They had Torah. And it's important to just get those facts back on the table in terms of what they should have had very much in the forefront of their minds as they pose these questions. All right, so rehash a quick summary. God has gone to indescribably great lengths for them. That's been part of what we've just said. What will their response be? It's their turn. Here it is. We'll take it piece by piece. With what shall I come before the Lord? In other words, how should I enter into the Lord's presence? That's the focus of the question, if we're going to call this an entrance liturgy, which some do. When I bow myself before the God of heaven. So, presuming that this is someone who has the right attitude, they want to be humble before God, should I come before him with burnt offerings, with year-old calves? Well, that's interesting. With what shall I come before the Lord? If you know the Psalms, you're well aware that that kind of question shows up in some of our favorite Psalms. How can I ascend, stand, approach the Lord? And, you know, this is talking about coming to Zion, and when we read those Psalms, obviously they are supposed to be, the persons who are asking them and asking that question are told, there's a whole character that has to be part of this picture. Someone who is truthful, someone who's righteous, someone who has pure hands, clean heart, clean, well, anyway, not accepting bribes. Those things are part of the being of someone who should be approaching the Lord. Well, obviously, as we read those Psalms, we know that that did not actually characterize the folks in Micah's day. The word bow myself is interesting because it's a word that means bow entirely. It's not just a nod to God's presence. This questioner is saying, how can I come into God's presence and bow myself entirely in his presence? That's worth noting. And then we have to ask about the offerings that this person is posing at first, right? According to Torah, these atoning sacrifices, very much necessary. You had to come with a sacrifice. So there was a whole process for doing that, to atone for sinful people. And if we're talking in terms of burnt offerings, well, that was part of it. Leviticus 1:4, the whole burnt offering, the olah, was necessary to atone for the sins. Your old calves, both of these costly, this one especially. They were used when the priests themselves, the mediators in this worship circumstance, were ordained. These are both, as this would-be worshiper is actually, you know, he's actually asking questions that make sense. Someone who had reasonable amount of means could bring them if they really wanted to. But of course, our next verse shifts to major hyperbole. Does the Lord desire, by the way, the first one was, how should I come? How should I come before? Now it's, what does he want anyway? Does the Lord desire, and here's the hyperbole, 1,000 rams, myriads of streams of oil, and then, should I give my firstborn for my transgression? The fruit of my belly is a sin offering for my soul. All of these are hyperbolic statements. And to be sure, you've got oil that's used in the sanctuary. Oil was mixed with the grain offerings. It was used to maintain the lamps in the sanctuary. There was a special anointing oil. But the question is, do I have to bring torrents of this oil? Rivers is too mild translation. Do I have to bring torrents, myriads of streams of oil? So we're obviously stepping into that area of hyperbole. And then, of course, the really horrifying one that has all kinds of implications. Should I give my firstborn for my transgression? Well, what is this about offering firstborns anyway? Is this simply hyperbole? Or, I mean, it is, but what is it based on? I guess that's my question. What is it based on? So let's step back and see if this would-be questioner has any basis in the long, ugly, sordid traditional history of Israel for making that kind of a query. Any basis at all? Well, sadly, here is our Psalm 106. Long psalm, these verses in the middle of it. They sacrificed their sons and their daughters to demons. They shed innocent blood, the blood of their sons and daughters, when they sacrificed to the idols of Canaan, and the land was desecrated by their blood. Again, Psalm 106 is one of those long history psalms. And so this is a declaration, and I don't think it's simply, you know, symbolic or overstatement. It seems to be that's what they were doing. Ahaz, and we've encountered him multiple times before as an apostate of apostates, passes his children through the fire. Later, King Manasseh is going to do the same kind of thing. Isaiah 57, you sacrificed your children in the ravines and under overhanging rocks. Again, probably not just figurative. Something else seems to be going on as part of their national, ugly, underbelly narrative. And just a quick note in terms of the Hebrew here. The word for burnt offering, which is olah, is in several contexts used to refer to human sacrifice. Normally it refers to the animal, but there's some cases where that same word shows up when there have been human sacrifices that are part of the picture. So now we're seeing some rather, it's ugly stuff going on. What are these questions pointing to? How is Micah presenting this would-be audience? Why in verse 7 is there such a radical escalation from, you know, animals and oil to offering the firstborn? I'm just going to pose some things. These are not necessarily one solid answer, but possibly Micah is being sarcastic. He's putting questions in the mouth of somebody that is styled as being very, very thinly remembering what is supposed to be part of this and just picking out categories. So, just to look through this a little more, this could be people's exaggerated and definitely ignorant claims if they want to really approach God. Maybe it's that. Poorly structured, bad memories. Don't we do that way too often? We think we have religious categories in our head and they end up not serving us well. Or, second possibility, a frantic crescendo on the part of the questioner, maybe speaking for the people, from what is indeed costly sacrifice to highly inflated numbers because they're in a really tight position. Face of panic, terrified at the approach of an enemy. How in the world can we placate God? Here we are, right up to the line. Can we do something suddenly to turn God around and make him be nice to us? Can we offer the absolute most we can? Maybe Micah is presenting them as having that kind of approach. Related to that, could this involve, and I've intimated this already, the notion that the sacrifice of a beloved child was an appropriate action? After all, a beloved firstborn son, the most important, valuable thing, I don't mean to use the thing, but possession that a person would have, being given to God. Perhaps a king would do this and be expected to do this. In the wider cultural context, we have evidence of children being sacrificed in these kinds of situations. So any one of these or a combination thereof could be part of this picture. It's hard to say, but it's also, obviously, by the time we get through these two verses, we've got questions that are representative of people who are panicked, out of control, not knowing what to do. And their questions presume they know what they're talking about, but obviously they don't. The Lord gives, through Micah, a very calm, measured, coherent, unlike their questions, response. And here it is, and this is the one that we probably memorize at some point. He has told you, O Adam, and I'm going to leave that as Adam on purpose, what is good? What does the Lord seek from you except doing justice and love of unfailing covenant love? That's the appropriate translation. And being careful to walk with your God. Now, let's unpack that just a little bit. The word Adam is kind of a collective referring to the people, but I'm going to suggest that maybe it's pointing them back or pointing us back to a wider human responsibility, too. This is what people ought to do if they're just normal, good people. They ought to be doing justice, kind of a common grace thing. At any rate, in terms of God's people, they should know what's good. God has told them what's good. Psalm 100, verse 5, for the Lord is good. His mercy everlasting, his covenant love endures forever. They should know this. It's so much part of what has just been part of the lesson they learned earlier in the chapter. Doing perfect justice, loving faithfully. Again, in terms of this three-part requirement, justice. Perry's talked about mishpat and how they were abusing it. Chesed, which is unfailing covenant love. These recur over and over and over again. And they are the foundation for the covenant, and obviously then they're going to be the foundation for the rebuke that follows. I'm just making a little connection there between the term unfailing covenant love, which you're not going to see anymore. You're going to see chesed, because there's really no single word that translates chesed appropriately. So keep in mind, this is unfailing covenant love. Loving chesed is used only here. Usually it's doing, right? Usually it's doing. Here it's used together, two terms that seem to overlap considerably. But Micah, as he usually does, is changing words and patterns enough to surprise his audience. So in the biblical text, it's only here. It does appear, as I note for you, in several Dead Sea texts as well. And I'm going to come back to them in a moment for another reason. All right. But what's this third part? Walk somehow with your God. What's supposed to characterize that? Generally speaking, in the stuff that we memorize, it's translated humbly. The word is hatsnea. In terms of trying to be a good dictionary person, we only see it here and in Proverbs 11, and it's contrasted in some way with pride in Proverbs 11, so that's probably where humbly comes from, maybe. It does occur in the Qumran text called the Community Rule. Very common text, one of the first ones that was found, Cave 1. And when you kind of pick apart that usage, and that's an interesting study all by itself, it comes at the end of the exploration, it means something like wise or wise decorum or something that means that we are acting circumspectly. So the point is to do justice in every aspect, to love loving relationships, and then to walk in a way that is wise and circumspect and not rash or whatever that happens to be. Now, just a note, and then we're going to move on. It's fascinating, and this is not my observation. I've lifted it from somebody else. People have been so consumed by how to translate that particular word that they've lost the focus on the main point, which is walk with God. Walk with God. If we're walking with God, however that word is supposed to be translated, will be working itself out quite nicely. Walk with God is the admonition. Well, just to kind of draw some of these things together, some folks sometimes read this and some other passages in Scripture and presume that, these requirements of sacrifice and all that stuff are not all that important anymore. That's not what this passage is getting at all. As I note, these requirements are not dismissed. In terms of a New Testament connection, it's interesting that Jesus will admonish the people around him to tithe dill, mint, and cumin. Those, by the way, are very small, very small, but not bypass justice, mercy, and faithfulness. To be sure, costly and highly emotional sacrifices and ceremonies, rituals, Amos will address that and say that's not what the Lord wants unless people's hearts are in the proper place. All right, we're needing to move along just a tad. I'm going to transition to the next verse, which is a challenging one, and then work towards the closure of the chapter. Verse 9, it's good to fear the Lord. But here's the translation, and it's one of these places where it's a bit challenging. Translation, the voice of the Lord will call to the city. Sound wisdom. He, not sure who, will fear, actually the verb is see, but it can easily interchange, fear, see, your name, and then hear, O tribe, and assembly of the city. Or, because the translation is challenging and the text is, heed the rod. What? Hear, O tribe, heed the rod, and the one who has appointed it. Now, if we had all hour to spend on this, we could parse that out. But here's what we can say, and I have it here in this segment. The voice of the Lord is calling. That ought to be taken seriously, regardless. The voice of the Lord is calling, and therefore they are to hear. They're to hear. And that whole summons to hear goes all the way back to the beginning of this chapter. How we parse out whether it's tribe or rod, those words in Hebrew are the same. They can mean both of those things. Whether we're talking about an assembly or an appointment, don't worry about that now. They're to hear. And that leads into things that are very clearly not doing justice and not loving chesed. What's happened? They're not hearing. The rest of our chapter is accusations. Again, difficult Hebrew, but we're going to do the best we can. Whatever is in italics, that's the challenging part, so bear with me on this. Verse 10, still, the Lord speaking, by the way, can I overlook the house of wickedness? Okay, challenging there. We'll come back to parts of that. The treasuries of wickedness. Well, that's not hard to figure out. If they've been amassing all kinds of money by virtue of their unjust dealings, they've got treasuries of wickedness. Or the cursed scanty ephah. Put that together with verse 11. Can I, the Lord, be considered or viewed as pure when there's wicked scales going on or a bag of deceitful stones? So even though there might be some difficult things to put together here, one of the things we're seeing is all kinds of economic exploitation, economic falsehood, stuff that the Lord just does not put up with. Verse 12 is another way of looking at it. Her rich men are filled with violence. Her inhabitants have spoken falsehood. This is Jerusalem, probably. Her tongue is treachery. That's not very nice to say about anybody. Just some clarification points. In that first verse that we looked at, house was there twice, and it could be House in Hebrew is Beit, but if you change the vocalization a little bit, it could be Bat, which happens to be a unit of liquid measure. And now, if that's true, the statement is being made that they are cheating. They're cheating on measurements, whether it's liquid measure or dry measure. And then the catalog of injustices. And I just note for you what you've probably already noted. This is so diametrically opposed with what the Lord has called them to, doing justice. A possible observation, the economic development under Uzziah may have been accompanied, we've suggested this already, may have been accompanied by shady dealings in the realm of commerce. It happens in every culture and society because we are evil people, given over to greed and things. Short measures, dishonest scales. Those are the things that are the ephah that we talked about in the bag of stones. And these things are an abomination to the Lord. An abomination to the Lord. Several additional notes, and then we'll move on. As I intimated, even though her is just a pronoun and it isn't specifically attached to Jerusalem, that's probably who it's referring to. Been addressing a city prior to this, and it's shot full of violence, deceit, and treachery. And the deceit, well, it's very clear in the book of Proverbs that lying lips are an abomination to the Lord over and over again. Verses 13 through 15, the Lord continuing to speak, also I, emphatic, have made you weak by smiting, again with that italics, we're having a little challenge there with translating it, ravaging you because of your sin. In contrast to you will eat but not be satisfied. It's going to be dark. You're going to try to do something, reach, overtake, maybe get to a place of security, but you're not going to bring into security. And those whom you do deliver, I'm going to give over to the sword. Now, I'm going to come back to the implications of that in just a moment. Verse 15, and you will sow and not reap. You will tread the olive and not anoint with oil. And from new wine you shall not drink. If you know your covenant blessings and curses, grain, new wine, and oil are sort of a hallmark, and we're seeing some of those show up here. To summarize that, the divine judge will punishment, and these judgments or chastisements are straight out of the covenant curses. So, enemies will overrun the country. We've referred over and over again to Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 27 and 28. Enemies. Famine will result, which means they're not going to have olives and grapes, their standard crops. All expectations of economic flourishing dashed, completely dashed. Whole economy is gutted and productivity grinds to a halt. That's what's going to happen to these people. And just a quick note, it refers to treading olives. Normally, when we think of these agricultural processing things, we would have treading grapes and pressing olives. But Micah says treading olives, which may indicate something about their desperation. Quick picture here. Here's what olive presses looked like. The one on the left does come from the first millennium BC. The one on the right is more of a first century AD, Jesus time. But you notice they're big operations. You dump your olives in there and then just really squash them with some pretty heavy stones. Treading is not what we would expect. Maybe they're doing it on a very small scale. All right. Well, Omri and Ahab, verse 16a, the statutes of Omri have been kept. Oh, isn't that good of them? They're busy doing what Omri has asked them to do. And every deed of the house of Ahab, well, you've walked according to their counsel. And I have a little note about just being aware of the irony here. They can't manage to do what the Lord has asked them to do, and they're forgetting all that, but oh, are they busy following what the dynasty of Omri had taught, which, of course, has to do a lot with false worship of Baal, etc., etc. So that's our question. What do we need to remember about Omri and Ahab? Just a little bit of a map. When Omri established his capital, where he did, at Samaria, and we talked about this in, I think, the first or the second lecture, it was as if he opened his arms wide geopolitically and said, welcome, I'm going to embrace all these cultural things, which means connections with Phoenicia and other points west, opulence of the Omri dynasty. Perry talked and showed some pictures last time around about Samaria and the ivories that were found there, which are just really clearly well done, well worked, and probably imported, indicating that this was an opulent time. Socioeconomically, appeared to be good. Religiously, horrible. I've suggested this already, woven into that whole fabric of embracing the socioeconomic advantages of Phoenicia and other places was that Jezebel, married to Ahab, Omri's son, they brought in the worship of Baal. It had already been there. It was part of the fabric of what's going on. We saw it in the Baal Peor incident. But here it becomes a state religion, the worship of Baal. And, of course, our theft of Naboth's vineyard, which Jezebel orchestrated, the revenge and the execution falsely of Naboth, that whole thing she was responsible for. And we suggested that when we read Micah 2, that incident may be behind the seizing property and seizing inheritance, possibly. Well, needless to say, it's a recipe for utter disaster. Close. Verse 16, last part. I am giving you to destruction and your inhabitants to hissing, and you will bear the reproach of my people. Destruction, humiliation, that's what hissing is all about, right? Reproach. And then he closes with my people. Now we're going to close with just a few reflections. And we can draw these lessons out of this chapter and other places as well. We should remember. Sometimes we don't do any better than the Israelites did, I'm afraid. But God calls us to remember and to know, as opposed to being forgetful of God's faithfulness. Kind of a tangent, not a tangent, but an ancillary to the material in verses 6 and 7. If we're thinking about approaching God, with what shall I approach him? More than anything else, we need to be overwhelmed by our need for atonement, more than anything else. And then two additional matters. So easy to fall into wider cultural values. Even after that challenge of verse 8, it's the height of ethics and wonderful, good worship of the Lord. The rest of the chapter is all about how they sank right back down to their cultural values. And they weren't very good. They weren't values. And then finally, just to kind of put us in the same crosshairs with the Israelites, we too slide back into these destructive and self-serving patterns. That's not a very happy note to close on, but we still have chapter 7 to go. So there you have it. End of chapter 6.
This is Dr. Elaine Phillips in her teaching on the book of Micah, Prophet Outside the Beltway. This is session number 7, Micah chapter 6.